Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
A great guest on the line. His recent book called Burned, and it's a story of murder and the crime that wasn't. The author is Edward Humes. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, okay, so Ed, let's get a little background on you. You haven't been on the show for listeners. How long have you been writing, and what got you into the true crime area in books?
Well, I've been writing since actually before I graduated college, starting in newspapers. And one of the main beats that I covered as a newspaper reporter was the courthouse. And so before I even started writing books, I had been to probably thousands of trials and hearings and such. And, you know, there's that great observation Calvin Trillin made years ago about why reporters love trials and writing about them and sitting at them, because it's the only place where someone is asked a question and they actually have to answer. They cannot say no comment. They cannot say, tell an unrelated anecdote or self-serving thing. They actually have to answer the question that they're asked. And I found that process sort of, nirvana for journalists to be in that situation. And the stories that usually emerged from that crucible were generally pretty fascinating. So that led me to my first temporary leave of absence from newspapers in 1989 to write my first book, and kind of been doing it ever since. They finally, you know, packed up my desk and sent me my stuff because I never went back.
Yeah. You never went missing. Body snatched.
Well, I was missing, but they, not in action. They knew where I was.
Yeah. Well, and Burned. Now, how did you come across this story?
Well, that started, I was interested in the work of the California Innocence Project. They had had, for a very small and woefully underfunded operation, they'd been having remarkable success overturning convictions of people who shouldn't have been in prison but were, usually on very serious cases, murder or nearly as serious major sex crimes and so forth. And using a number of techniques, but mostly the power of DNA, which is not just a powerful way to catch guilty people, but also for proving their innocence. And they've had a lot of luck with that, but they've taken on other cases too. And as I was sitting there just watching how sort of reverse detective work that the lawyers and volunteers do at an Innocence Project, I discovered this case that they had tackled of Joanne Parks, who was accused in 1989 of setting fire to her house deliberately and trapping her three young children inside. And it was a sensational murder case in Los Angeles when it was tried in the early 1990s, and she's been in prison ever since. But as with so many of our other forensic sciences in recent years, there's been serious questions raised about the so-called fire science that was used to convict her. You know, and what seemed like scientific certainty in 1989 has been revealed as basically guesswork in disguise. And a prominent expert who trains fire investigators how to investigate fires properly said in testimony at a recent hearing in our case that there was not only no evidence that she had committed a crime, but there was no scientific evidence to suggest any crime had been committed at all in the,
oh, wow,
the house. So that's why the subtitle is The Crime That Wasn't.
Well, what is it? It's just kind of what draws you into writing, because there's plenty of stories out there. So when you choose a story and decide you're going to write on it, what's the foundation? Like, what is the criteria for you?
It varies, but generally, it's I like crime stories that first have compelling characters. In this case, I found the attorney working at the Innocence Project an intriguing person, very dedicated, and actually, you know, you think, oh, defense attorneys, it's completely different, but from people in law enforcement. But actually, she's like the mirror image of a tough homicide detective. It's just that she's sort of trying to unravel the case rather than put it together. But the work is very much the same, and it's fascinating to watch. I like the character of Joanne Parks, but she's kind of ambiguous. She has no constituency. She wasn't a particularly personable person. She's been institutionalized from spending more time in prison than she's spent out now, although she had no prior offenses before this arrest in the arson case. But because this isn't a DNA case, you can't just march in and say there is absolute evidence of her innocence. It's there's some ambiguities in it, and I find that a more interesting story than absolute certainty. And the other thing I like about a crime story is often, I think the best ones have a backstory, a context that involves larger issues of interest to everyone. In this case, it's how our forensic sciences have so little science behind many of them, and that's an important issue because it affects all of us in one way or another.
So, what happens in this particular case when they took her to trial and convicted her? It was based on what they thought was fire evidence at the time.
Correct.
So now, since then, has it been proven that it's totally incorrect, or is it just not reliable? Like, what was the final result on the way they did fire investigation?
Well, in that era, there were many beliefs that fire investigators had sort of just assembled anecdotally over the years and passed on to their next generation of fire investigators, and basically it addressed ways in which you can interpret what's left when after a fire occurs, the way certain patterns appear on the floors and walls and ceiling, the speed with which the fire seems to proceed through a dwelling or a business, what the indicators of an accelerant being used, like gasoline or some other flammable liquid being doused onto a fire. And there was a lot of beliefs about that, and they called it arson science, but there wasn't any actual scientific research behind it. If you peel back how they know what they said they knew, there was nothing there in terms of laboratory testing or the fallibility or lack of errors, any kind of examination of how reliable an expert in fire science was when they went into a house and reached a conclusion about what caused the fire. Was there any validation for them even being able to tell what they said they could tell? There wasn't. And that only has recently come to light, mainly through the findings of organizations like the National Academy for Sciences and a presidential commission in 2016 that began probing into forensic sciences in general. All these magical and seemingly dispositive techniques that are lionized on shows like CSI, the CSI franchise, you know, where the crime gets solved by comparing bullets or hair and fibers in, you know, in 42 minutes, leaving room for commercials over the 6 minutes. None of that actually works that way. And oftentimes it doesn't work. And fire science is almost the poster child for overreach in terms of what was thought they could prove at the time in 1989. And it's been a slow realization that a lot of that just was mythology.
So in this particular case, what is it that they said she did? And I mean this in the way of if there was no real evidence of gasoline or, you know, they didn't know exactly what she did to cause the fire, what is it they presume she did?
Yeah, that's really interesting, because one of the classic claims when a defendant is brought to trial is if they keep changing their story, it must not, you know, they must be lying, right? And you can't believe anything they say. Well, the prosecution just kept changing their story about what caused the fire, but, you know, apparently they are not held to the same standard as a defendant, because that didn't seem to trouble anyone. But basically what they said was that when this house burned, it burned very fast and very hot, and, you know, fire is the one, when it is a crime, it's the one, arson is the one crime that, you know, destroys the evidence of the crime as it progresses. And there's a phenomenon once a fire reaches a certain level of intensity called flashover, where literally every combustible surface and substance in a room, including ash flying in the air, catches fire. It's a fatal event when that occurs if someone is trapped in a room that enters the flashover phase. And that can happen within 5 minutes or less of the start of a fire under the right conditions. The problem with a fire scene in which flashover occurs and is sustained for more than just a few seconds is that it basically makes any intelligible evidence disappear. It's very hard to make an accurate read of the burn patterns and so forth once flashover occurs. So a key part of the testimony in the original trial against Joanne Burns was that flashover did not occur. It did not preach that point, and therefore the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department arson investigator, who was the lead expert in the case, could march into court and confidently testify that he could read those burn patterns like a book and could tell that that fire had been deliberately set. And initially, for 1 year leading up to the trial, he said that Joanne Parks had started the fire by sabotaging electrical extension cords in such a way that they caught fire in the living room, and that just to make sure the kids were burned to death, she also set a fire by hand in the one of the children's bedrooms. Later, as trial date approached, an electrical engineer was asked to examine those electrical cords to bolster the idea that they started the fire, and upon testing and examination, the engineer said, well, these cords burned from the outside in, not from the inside out, which meant they were consumed in the fire. They didn't start the fire, and he conclusively determined that that was not the cause. Well, the whole reason for suspecting arson in the first place was this supposed incendiary device this young waitress constructed. And so instead of stepping back and saying, boy, everything we thought about how this fire started and where it started is wrong, they said, oh, well, if it didn't start because she sabotaged those wires, she must have just taken matches and set the fire right on that same spot, on top of the electrical cords. And so they didn't change anything. They didn't rethink anything.
Oh, wow.
Now we know flashover did occur in there. Every expert, modern expert who's looked at it, says, oh, yeah, flashover. It makes it very difficult to make these kinds of calls.
Wow. But isn't that a problem in convictions on a whole right now? We see that in a lot of cases that are coming out, such as this, where people were convicted wrong, and we find out later, and how the policing kept on pushing with their theory no matter what evidence was thrown at them.
Yeah, you know, they used to call that tunnel vision. Now it has a more scientific term, interestingly enough, cognitive bias, or confirmation bias, or expectation bias. And this is another hot topic in the forensic community now, and what role, if any, it plays in wrongful convictions. So there's a fascinating setup to the Burns case. This is another reason why I think this is just an amazing story. The initial walkthrough by the first arson investigator on the scene of the house made a preliminary conclusion, pending further investigation, that it was an accidental fire, possibly electrical in origin. But there was no thinking that this was a crime at first. And, you know, there was extensive news coverage, and Joanne Parks's tearful face was on every newscast in the city of Los Angeles, and she was treated like a grieving mother, not as a criminal. But 3 days after the fire and all this press coverage, somebody calls up and the police and says, "Well, I used to be Joanne's best friend, and let me tell you, that was no accident. She killed those children," and went on to tell this story of how conversation in which Joanne Parks lamented that having three children at her young age, and that if only one of them had died in an accident, she could collect $1 million in insurance coverage. There had been a minor fire in a previous apartment they lived in, and she was referring to that. Nobody was hurt or injured or anything, but said, "Oh, if only little Jessica had been trapped in there." Supposedly, this is what Joanne Parks said, and the police heard that and were horrified. And so they called in a different arson investigator, and instead of letting him just go in and taking another look, they briefed him on all this hideously negative information about Joanne Parks and her desire for her children to die. And these new arson investigators saw signs of arson everywhere when they walked through this very same house. Nobody saw any such thing. What's controversial now, but nobody gave a second thought then, is, gee, if we want somebody to go in and make a scientific determination of physical evidence in a crime scene, do we really want them to know this biasing information in advance? Could that color their judgment? Who knows? But wouldn't it be better to make sure that it doesn't, and exclude that unnecessary extraneous information from the supposed scientific analysis? So that's how this idea of cognitive bias comes in, when you have to make a judgment. Gee, does this fire burn pattern show something suspicious or not? Well, if you know all this, you already know you're supposed to find that this person did it, that can color your judgment. That's happened with fingerprints, it's happened with dental comparisons, it's happened over and over throughout wherever forensic analysts are, you know, kind of contaminated by extraneous information like that. The kicker is that friend never even testified in the trial because her information was either like laughable, incoherent, or disproven. None of it held up. None of it was actually used in the trial, but had colored the entire investigation.
So, yeah, is that what turned the public against her as well?
Oh, yeah. The prosecutor got up in open court and declared her one of the most heinous murders Los Angeles had ever seen. And there was a lot of lengthy... There was a two-year delay between the fire and charging, so that there had been sympathetic coverage initially, and also coverage, by the way, the slumlord who owned the property that caught fire was notorious for poor conditions and unsafe conditions in his many properties. That line of investigation just was stillborn once the tunnel vision focused on Parks.
Yeah, we've seen it many, many times in different crimes that you mentioned tunnel vision. They get one suspect in their view, and that confirmation bias kicks in, which is the tendency to search for things that confirm your hypothesis, your pet hypothesis. It's not even an evil thing
much.
It's not intentional. It's just human nature to do to head off in that direction that you think is correct.
Yes, and thank you for making that point, because I think that's important. No one is claiming, and certainly I'm not claiming that there was malfeasance or a deliberate covering up of the truth in this case. You know, these investigators did what they were trained to do. If you ask them, were you biased, they'd say, no, of course not. I mean, it's not that kind of bias. We all have this problem. It's how our brains are wired to connect the dots, to find patterns, and that's greatly influenced by our prior knowledge. And the famous example of this case happened with the Madrid terrorist bombing back in 2004. Where the vaunted FBI identification unit, the world's leading fingerprint experts, linked three different examiners, or maybe it was four, linked the prints found on a unexploded bag with a bomb inside it to a Portland, Oregon attorney.
Oh, wow.
Who had converted to Islam and had, I guess, defended some characters that the feds considered were shady. So he was a person of interest, and they matched his fingerprints to the crime scene and gave that information to the Spanish authorities and to Interpol, and locked this guy up for 17 days, and nobody could, you know, he was in deep lockup. And then Madrid authorities called the FBI and said, well, we don't know why you're holding this this Portland dude, because we positively matched this prince to an Algerian terrorist, and he's in custody here. And they just got it wrong. They knew all that. They knew he was the suspect, and they had a low-quality print with only certain points of comparison that were solid, and the first examiner to look at was one of the senior best guys there at the FBI identification unit, and he made the call, and then it was reviewed, as is always the case, by multiple other examiners. But they were all had been mentored by this one who made the initial call, and they all knew he had found a match before they looked, so they all found a match too.
There you go. And next thing you know, we're not inoculating our babies for measles.
Yes, well, exactly. You know, it's now begun, but there was never any testing to see how accurate human beings are in matching poor quality fingerprints.
Yeah.
Well, there is an error rate for everything a human being does, and it may be a small error rate, but we know that there have been errors, and there have been wrongful convictions in addition to this false arrest in the Madrid case, and yet we have this feeling that fingerprint evidence is irrefutable. Yeah. Well, most of the time it is. It is great evidence, but it's not perfect, and recognizing that and recognizing the fallibility is an important part to making sure we get the just result.
All science is in a way subjective.
Well, you know, scientists will say we're constantly trying to screen out the subjective, or when it's unavoidable, as it is when you're trying to match things, to minimize it. And one way you minimize that is to remove the contributing factors of cognitive bias.
Right.
These examiners should have been testing these fingerprints in the blind without knowing who belonged to what the stakes were, because they did do blind testing with the same examiners and the same prints without telling them they were the same, and none of them found a match.
There you go.
They didn't know what it was. So that simple step, isolating the analysts and the scientists from the extraneous information, is critical to ensure that we don't have these kinds of mistakes, or at least to minimize them. And yet, think about who controls all our forensic sciences. Pretty much all of them.
Yeah.
either a police department or it's, you know, analog in terms of the FBI or a sheriff's department or the prosecuting agencies.
There's a built-in agenda already.
Would you feel good about going into the World Series where the, you know, the other team got to pay and supervise and manage and fire and hire all the umpires? Would that work for you?
No.
There'd always be a doubt that it wasn't on the up and up because one side had all the power. And if we propose, well, let's let the defense attorneys be in charge of all our forensics, people would think that would be an outrage and it would be absurd. And it would be absurd. Why isn't it absurd that the the other side controls all the process, all the players in what is supposed to be a dispassionate, unbiased scientific review? So
yeah. Great answer to that question, by the way.
I think in these times, I think that people do not trust any sort of government agencies too much right now.
Well, even if they're operating in good faith, which I would say they almost always are when it comes to doing these tests, they're still, this is how it typically works. You get a detective or you get a prosecutor and they call up the coroner's office or the crime lab or you name it and say, hey, we got this guy, we know he's good for this murder, he's good for this rape, or he's good for this, you know, forgery, whatever. She set the fire.
Sets that narrative in the scientist's brain.
Yeah. What do you got for us? And many of these aren't scientists, but they're technicians who consider themselves part of law enforcement. So first they want to help. They want to achieve justice. They want and that's their job. That's their mission. But it puts them in a difficult position where they're influenced in ways that are profound and yet just seem like normal communications.
Hmm. So now the California Innocence Project is challenging Park's conviction. And so where does that stand right now?
Well, there was a hearing, and the way it's called the habeas corpus process. It's the Great Writ. It's a huge part of justice system since before there was a United States. And the principle is that the state can be challenged to prove that its evidence is valid in a criminal conviction, and and this was how this writ was used by William Penn to get his freedom from the Tower of London. So it's a bedrock legal principle, and in this case, there has to be a showing of that there's a problem with Joanne Parks' conviction or anybody else's, and once that legal determination is made by a trial court judge, a superior court judge in California, which is the level of court where the trial occurs in the first place. That finding was made, and so it led to a hearing, and to briefs, and to expert testimony about what happened in the fire that killed Joanne Parks' three young children, ages 1, 2, and 4. And that hearing stretched out over a year, and it was fascinating. But it really came down to each side getting experts in there to render a scientific opinion in the case as to whether or not the original findings were valid. And as often happens in these cases, each side had experts that radically disagreed with the other sides. And there was only one expert in the case that did actually had scientific data and basically created a map of what you could and couldn't tell in that house when that fire occurred. And it was a tiny little house. It was under 600 square feet. It was a converted garage turned into a small apartment, and it just went up like a matchbox.
Wow.
But the judge, because the other experts disagreed and said, oh, no, well, flashover occurred. That was false evidence in the case. But you could still tell how this fire started. And they had no science to back that up. They just said, no. And so our years of experience tells us that this was arson. The judge interpreted that by saying, hey, you know, these vaunted experts in fire science still can't agree after 30 years. It's all controversial now, so I'm not gonna pick a side. I'm not gonna disturb the jury's verdict until the fire science community can agree unanimously on what happened here. And basically, he punted the case. And so far, it's been just recently the California Court of Appeal, without comment, you know, in one page, declined to review the case. So now it goes to the state Supreme Court. That's what's happening right now.
Now, if they decide to retry or to overturn this, where would it go? Like, and how does this affect other cases that were prosecuted with the same sort of fire evidence?
If there is a ruling, an opinion that discusses the problems in this case issued by the state Supreme Court, that would have a statewide impact. And because the California Supreme Court is influential in the rulings of other courts around the country, it could have a greater effect. If it proceeds beyond the state Supreme Court into the federal court system, then its possible effects on investigations throughout the country start to accumulate depending on what the result is. I'd say that in terms of bringing these issues out into the light and stimulating discussion in the among law enforcement agencies and fire investigators and so forth, it's part of a larger process in which forensic science reforms are happening. I think even though the system is reluctant to concede that errors were made, that and then letting people out of prison, that there's that's no matter how poor the forensic evidence, it's generally not something that police and prosecutors easily accept. Even with that sort of built-in barrier, the new investigations that are occurring and the next generation of investigators are cognizant of these issues in cases like the Parks case and have changed the way they do business moving forward. So that's a positive outcome.
Wow. Now, when you worked or talked with the California Innocent Projects and you're doing research, do you find that are they just inundated with cases like this? Do they have, is there a lot of cases, and I'm trying to think, how do they decipher what's real and what's not? That must take a lot of work.
Well, that's it's a fascinating process, and that's one of the things I was interested in, because they hear from thousands of every year, thousands and thousands of convicts or the families of people sent to prison who don't believe that they're loved ones committed the crime. Sometimes they get referrals from trial or the lawyers who lost but think that their clients were wrongfully convicted. They only take a very small number of cases among this huge deluge of material they receive, and they go through them all. Many of them are on their face not something that either the facts don't support a wrongful conviction or the law doesn't. And they need both to be something they think it might be that there could be a strong case to be made for both, or they won't take the case. So out of the thousands they get every year, they may take on 25 at a time and work on those for years in some cases. So they're very selective, which is kind of interesting. It's different than another kind of legal operation that would just represent any accused person who walks in the door. Mm. They actually are representing people they think are either legally innocent or factually innocent. And those are two different things, of course.
What do you hope people get out of the book? When they finish reading it, what is it that you want them to walk away with?
I think they one thing would be it would be good for them to realize is that the you know that all the CI stuff is that's just a fictional show, and in fact the our forensic sciences are not in the shape that we want them to be. You know, when you have a heinous murder like the Parks case, you would think that the investigators and prosecutors wouldn't want to move forward with something like that. It was such a horrible accusation unless they knew everything was rock solid, that the science was beyond challenge. But that was not the case. There's more... There's more science behind the stuff in your refrigerator in terms of the testing for safety and health and contents than there is in these practices that are used to send people to prison for life or to death row. And we can do better than that. We know we can do better than that, but yet the system has been very reluctant to course correct, and the impact of this goes beyond murder cases, which is serious enough because in many cases when the forensic analysis is wrong and the wrong person gets convicted, that means that the right person, the real criminal, is still out there. One of the cases the California Innocence Project took on was someone sent to prison for being a serial rapist, the teardrop rapist, because of a teardrop tattoo he had on his cheek, and he was in prison for 17 years. Before it was shown that he was innocent through DNA evidence of the crimes he was committed to of doing, and not only that, but while he was in prison, the police knew that the same type of crimes with the same MO were still ongoing, and that they had not caught the teardrop rapist, and they have never caught the teardrop rapist. So bad things happen when bad forensics is used to send people to prison. People are denied insurance coverage when their houses are burned because of bad arson investigations.
I'm just reading about this Luis Vargas, the teardrop rapist. He could have served 55 years to life for these sexual assaults. That's crazy.
Yes, and it was bad eyewitness testimony that was the primary fault, and suggestive lineups, and witnesses were allowed to change their description at the under subtle pressure from the police, or hints given to them, and that was a bad case. And so we all have a vested interest in seeing that we get this kind of investigation right. And it's ironic that it's DNA evidence, which has excellent science behind it, that has not only improved the ability of the authorities to catch really bad people, but has revealed these flaws in the other forensic sciences. About one in four of the thousands of convictions that have been overturned because of DNA and the work of organizations like the California Innocence Project, about a fourth of those the convictions were based at least in part on other forensic conclusions that turned out to be junk science.
Oh. I better watch myself now.
Oh, boy.
I'll be in trouble. Do you have a website now, Ed, that people can
go
to?
I do. It's very easy to remember because it's my name, edwardhumes.com.
Excellent.
Perfect. And, of course, your book is available in all fine bookstores and online, Amazon, I imagine. Fantastic.
Anywhere you can find a book or an audio book, you can find it. So.
Yeah, audio books are the best for us old guys.
Indeed.
Well, Ed, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. And the book is called Burned. It's a story of murder and the crime that wasn't. We'll have that linked on our website as well, so people can do one click as they're listening and pick up the book.
Oh, thanks. I hope they do.
Thanks so much, Ed.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.